But today, as I say, I'm delighted we have a speaker. I actually took the precaution of printing out a lecture I gave in Washington about a month ago, which was fairly controversial in the hope that if you were disappointed at not having Alan, I might at least stir up an interesting conversation. But it was a great sigh of relief when I heard that Alan was coming that I put it back into my desk again. Alan is a real treat to have here. We've had him once before. He knows the Middle East probably as well as anybody I know, and he's worked there both politically and he's worked there commercially before that. I won't read out the whole of his very long biography, but he was Minister of State for, for International Development since the last election in May 2010. He stood down at his own request last night, and he may want to say something about that. But I'm delighted not only he's here, but I reminded him of that Latin phrase, felix sclavus liberatus est, happy is the slave who has been freed. And I hope that freedom may even colour some of the things he says to us today, which he might not have been able to say had he still been in the government. But I'm delighted he's here. He was president of the Oxford Union. He had a Kennedy scholarship at Harvard University. He worked in oil in the Middle East as an oil trader, and beyond that in Pakistan with a franchise in Land Rovers. He was in the shadow front bench for many years, including a spell he probably would prefer to forget when he worked with me on the foreign affairs side. I was delighted to have his advice. But as I say, he was invited because of the job he was doing, but I hope he feels now that he can go even further than he would have on that occasion. So I'm delighted to ask Alan to address us. Alan Duncan.
Michael, thank you. I think Henry Kissinger was once introduced with the sentence, "This is a man who needs no introduction." He said, "You're quite right, I need no introduction, but no one enjoys one more than I do." Thank you for such a comprehensive launch, for what you have dignified with the title of a lecture. But given the busyness of the last couple of days and the reshuffle last night, I feel a bit like a schoolboy who hasn't quite done all the homework that he should have done. But I have concluded 4 years as a different minister, and I'd like to draw on that experience and my longer experience travelling around the Gulf in particular, just to give you, if you like, a canter over the region, to share my thoughts, and then, because there are many former ambassadors and experts who will have specialisms amongst you in greater depth than me, we can perhaps have some questions and discussions about the individual countries I'm going to mention. I've entitled it, "The Arab Spring, Can Britain Piece It Together Again?" A rather pretentious title, I'm afraid, as if to suggest that Britain can do anything these days in the region with sufficient authority and clout, but in a way that in itself answers part of the question and explains a world that has changed since the days when we did have such influence and were drawing lines on the map, which are now still causing so much difficulty today. Humpty Dumpty, the map is very much shattered and somewhat scrambled, and I think piecing together again what we have enjoyed in the past is going to be nigh on impossible. Indeed, I suppose 13 or 14 years ago, when Michael was Shadow Foreign Secretary and I was his deputy, we could travel the region and meet people who had been there a long time. And there was a certain stability of structure and power which has, over the last few years, been in many areas completely shattered. We met the likes of Arafat and Mubarak and Ariel Sharon, and perhaps a lot of the debate has not changed, even if the people have, but certainly the pressures inside all of the countries which we visited has most definitely changed, and I think the future of many of them is going to be very unpredictable. But let me start by saying what I think the fulcrum is in terms of what is right and what is wrong in the region. And that has to focus on the Arab-Israeli dispute. To many people, this is the origin of double standards across the world. Indeed, in the actions of foreign policy and in the belief of Congress, it is a source of widespread moral indignation, which is certainly not being allayed at the moment. And my starting point in everything I say is this. This is not about process. It is above all about principle. It is about what is right and what is wrong, and the continued gradual annexation of someone else's land is wrong. And that has to be the starting point of all understanding in the region, in my view. So now that I'm free and no longer a minister, this is something that you will hear more from me, I predict. Let me just look then at the phenomenon which we perhaps again rather arrogantly have chosen to label the Arab Spring, as if we're entitled to define the phenomenon from where we sit. A phenomenon which is deeply complicated and different in each and every single country. But I suppose stepping back and looking at it, it had different characteristics in different countries. And in the GCC countries in particular, it could perhaps be described as a youthquake, where young people in countries which are relatively rich compared with the others do not have jobs, but they do have very high expectations and an attitude of entitlement which they feel is being unmet by their leaders. But it was a phenomenon, I think, of much deeper economic and political malaise elsewhere. And the difference has been that in the GCC there were enough resources to be able to buy off trouble, albeit things got pretty hairy in Bahrain. But looking at the non-GCC countries, you're looking at much deeper mayhem and, of course, consequent regime change, which is leading to what could eventually turn out to be contagion, if not near contagion. As of today, looking at the likes of Iraq and even some of the other countries I want to talk about, it's fair to say that almost anything could happen. So if you'll allow me, I'm just going to canter across the countries that have been affected with a few little vignettes. I'm not pretending that I'm giving you a deep and comprehensive analysis of each, but I just want to give a flavour of how I think all of this can be seen to be pieced together. And strangely, perhaps, one of the paradoxes of this phenomenon is that the country where it all started, Tunisia, is the one that has faded away most from the news and can almost be parked to one side. Libya, on the other hand, where the United Kingdom government played a significant part in bringing down Muammar Gaddafi, and where I played my own part in trying to make sure that the Benghazi end got their oil in and out and the Gaddafi end did not, has not switched into the great resource-based idyll. Perhaps even I optimistically thought it could. I've been there a few times as a deputy minister, and as a former oil trader, the picture is grim. What should be exports of 1.65 barrels a day is jogging along at about 200,000 barrels a day. And you've got this triangular problem, which is that the economy needs the oil, the politicians need the money from the oil, but to get the oil in the first place, you need the security which comes from strong politicians. And none of this is cohering yet in a way which is leading to the revenues which are necessary for cohesive government. When I was there 2 weeks ago, they were actually very optimistic, thinking that within a matter of 2 or 3 months, they could get production up to 600,000, 700,000, even 800,000 barrels. And indeed, there are two ports which have recently opened towards the eastern end, Marsa Al Dariga and Asida. But whether this is going to lead to the early increase in produced volume is another matter. You need engineers, and a lot of those expat engineers have left. The politics is very vexed. They've gone through a number of prime ministers. I saw Prime Minister Thinney, and he's doing his very best. And I think we can place some hope in the fact that the envoys who've been appointed, Jonathan Powell and David Satterfield of the Americans, are two figures who I think are going to have a significant influence over the government. And if, notwithstanding Khalifa Haftar's buccaneering efforts around Benghazi, they can piece together a government which is more effective, then if the resources do flow, there is yet hope. In terms of what the UK is doing, We are doing our bit. We've got a £62.5 million security and justice and defence programme, which at the moment has got hundreds of Libyans being trained in Bassingbourne. And without those underpinning characteristics of the government, there is no hope. So I hope at least that we as the UK are doing something to piece together the jigsaw of government. Watch carefully, however, the Egyptians just getting anxious about the eastern border. One has to hope that nothing erupts there, but there were mutterings and dangers when I was there. Moving on to Egypt. It, of course, is pivotal in terms of population, the origins of Arab nationalism, and everything else. It's also the country which the likes of the UAE are watching very carefully as they fear the actions of the Muslim Brotherhood moving more to their own backyard. Hence a very close link now between Mohammed bin Zayed and General Sisi, brokered in many respects by Tony Blair, who no doubt is banking it, find a coincidence of interest in wanting to expunge extremist elements affecting both countries. I think it's true to say that we made a mistake. We were too quick to say good riddance to Mubarak, and too quick to believe that at the flick of a switch, democracy could appear overnight in a country like Egypt. This, I think, was naive, and it has cost us in terms of our reputation, I think, in the wider Gulf, and has needed quite a lot of repair work for us to restore our reputation as people who understand the region. But crucially, the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi and Morsi's victory has galvanized vitriolic anxiety about radicalism more widely across the region. But it has meant that with General Sisi coming in, let's admit it, Egypt is once again a security state. And what will be interesting, I think, is to see how a failing economy can be handled by General Sisi, particularly when he has just removed all fuel subsidies and prices have gone up. How will he marry order with economic unhappiness? Let's watch that one very closely. On Yemen, I've been going to Yemen for 30 years, bought their first exported cargo of oil in 1986, made quite a good turn, that was all right, went back for more. But it has meant that I've had an abiding interest in the country, which coincidentally has been one of my main responsibilities in DFID. And it's the one country which has actually had a relatively peaceful transition. The GCC initiative, assisted by Jamal Ben Ammar from the UN, has actually been effective in removing Ali Abdullah Saleh and bringing in his deputy, President Hadi, with whom I've developed very close relations over the last year. We, helped by DFID, have seen them have a national dialogue, which has tried to bring together all the competing factions to agree what the political future should be. They are now going through some constitutional drafting. But the real truth is that the security backdrop is pretty dire, with Al-Qaeda in the south, the extremist elements of ISLA causing President Hadi no end of grief, but crucially and dramatically over the last 2 weeks, the advance of the Shia Houthi from the north to the edge of Baghdad, even taking Amran and the whole of the 310 battalion and all their weaponry, which is now, of course, in their hands and can be used. Donor funds have been pledged, but they have not been dispersed. Too much administrative chaos. But with Hadi going to Saudi Arabia last week and getting a promise of $2 billion, there's a chance that when that is combined with the IMF package that is on offer, there can be a significant degree of economic reform which can remove fuel subsidies, which consume over a third of the national budget, but which mostly go into the hands of rich smugglers, and can use perhaps $300-400 million to soften the blow of fuel subsidy reform and rebalance the economy. So there's an element of hope, but next week will be the key to see whether this economic package can be banked. Moving on to Syria, it is the most insoluble and complex issue I have ever seen in the region. And I defy anyone to think that they have a straightforward solution to the problem. I most certainly do not. Whereas it might have started with an element of goodies versus baddies, with the regime as the baddies and the moderate rebels as goodies. Nothing now is so simple, and it's so entwined and includes so many extremist elements in urban civil war. Disentangling the Syrian conflict is nigh on impossible at the moment. And of course the knock-on effects to Jordan and Lebanon are severe. That is why we, the UK, have spent $1 billion, the largest humanitarian intervention ever, on the Syrian problem. Half of it inside Syria, half of it on refugees in Lebanon and Jordan. And this is going to continue, but we'll do so in the face of very severe donor fatigue, where I fear the needs of Syrian refugees are not going to be met by the international community for very much longer, particularly as other problems, be it Gaza, Iraq, or anything else, are growing. In Iraq, my view, I'll be interested to hear yours, is it's only just beginning. Maliki has been irresponsibly provocative with his sectarian divisiveness. The country is disintegrating, at least into three. The ISIL threat is real and advancing, something Michael warned people about as much as 2 years ago, but nobody listened. Although Kurdistan may have more autonomy and more confidence, there will remain a problem about whether the world community will look upon people who purchase their oil as doing so legally or not. And so the commercial tidiness of this division in oil ownership remains a mess. And there are 650,000 displaced people. So the problem that was Syria has now spread into Iran. While Iran, the bogeyman for so many years, is semi-rehabilitated. I think Oman's brokering, particularly with the United States, has been very adept. The Sultan takes a very long-term view about Iran. He looks across the narrow straits and knows that they are a well-resourced, potentially much richer neighbour, and is wise to try and consider what his country can do with them in a long-term strategic relationship. And yet, Iran is still causing difficulty in Lebanon and Yemen, and given that the nuclear deal is as yet inconclusive, it is not yet near being a fully welcome member of the international community. There are other problems. There are deep ructions within the GCC. What, in the face of it, over many years has looked like a happy club, really has some pretty scratchy and unhappy relationships now within it. To many, particularly the UAE, Qatar is the bogeyman. We have seen the arrest of two Qataris, supposedly for spying. A lot of these relationships are very fractious. Saudi Arabia was none too pleased with the Sultan of Oman's negotiations with and on behalf of the Iranians. So the happy, tidy family, which perhaps casual observers of the Gulf states think is the case, is, in my view, far from the truth. So I think what we've seen in the so-called Arab Spring is a number of phases. We've had the balance of regime change, and within the GCC, the bolstering of existing regimes. We've seen the increasing awareness of that underlying and continuous threat, which has always existed, but has come much more to the fore, the fight and the hatred between Sunni and Shia. We've begun to see the disintegration of some of these young nation states. And we've now come, if not full circle, at least into a new phase where perhaps it's true to say that for some of them, my enemy's enemy is my friend, even to the point where the Saudis are backing the Shias in Baghdad. So let's just go back to where I started, which is Arab-Israeli conflict. We in DFID, I in particular, was arguing a year ago that Gaza was going to explode, that it was going to run out of power, water, food, and therefore patience. What goes on in Gaza makes it almost uninhabitable. And to see rockets firing is deplorable. It's also very stupid. And Hamas are at their weakest. So this is the most idiotic tactic they could ever employ. But unfortunately, its effect has been to pull the moral rug from under the broader Palestinian cause, which I deeply regret because, in my view, they do have a moral cause. So in terms of the UK, we will continue to support the Palestinian Authority. We, I think, have made a significant contribution to stabilising and maintaining Yemen and keeping it from collapse. We've ploughed massive resources into Syria, Jordan and Lebanon. It's all good stuff, but the honest truth, if I'm to answer the question put at the beginning of the lecture, is that it is of limited strategic impact. So perhaps I can just conclude by reading two paragraphs which perhaps explain the dilemma we're going to have to wrestle with over the coming months and years. And it goes as follows. Our capacity to craft a coherent Middle East security policy is becoming increasingly difficult because of the complexity of the cross-currents in the region. We're trying to advance the peace process against a backdrop of the proscribed Hamas in a Palestinian unity authority and the egregious Israeli settlement policy, and reconcile with Tehran on the nuclear issue while trying to thwart its regional ambitions. To support the Shia government in Iraq on the basis it is democratically elected, although it has been self-defeatingly sectarian, while helping to overthrow the Shia government in Syria, although both regimes are critically dependent on their close relationship with Iran. At the same time, we're supporting the Sunni Gulf monarchies, quite rightly, and the Sunni opponents of Assad, but only those Sunni elements we deem moderate, because the more extremist Sunnis are among those now threatening Baghdad and our Gulf allies, although some are funded by the Gulf states themselves. These same extremists will pursue international jihad, which will constitute a direct threat to ourselves, not least by contributing to radicalization within our own domestic security arena. Sadly, many of those with democratic credentials have proved to be illiberal because they simply have viewed electoral victory as an opportunity for winner takes all and the suppression of opposition. Conversely, illiberal regimes begin to be perceived as having historically given a better deal to secularists, to minorities and women, among others, than most current so-called democratic alternatives. The democratic so-called governments of Morsi and Maliki proved to be sectarian, discriminatory, divisive and incompetent, while the autocratic governments of Sisi and the Gulf monarchies will only permit narrowly defined political participation or dissent. However, the latter group hold the key to Suez security, the peace with Israel, stability in Jordan, the livelihoods of 200,000 UK expatriates, the fight against extremist Islam, and also energy price stability and global energy access. So put all that in the pot, and clearly our work is not yet done.